I'm Diana. I'm an alcoholic. We won't discuss that, okay? I was not originally scheduled to do this evening. I was scheduled to do it, but not this evening. And the person who was supposed to do it this evening is ill, and so I'm filling in for her. And so what you hear tonight is truly going to be God's words, because I have no idea what I'm going to say. I want to thank the group for asking me to participate in my own sobriety. I consider it an honor and a privilege. I also want to thank Paul for going ahead of me. Paul doesn't know this, but he's one of the he's one of my icons in AA. I got sober in Los Angeles and spent the first 19 years of my sobriety in LA, and then moved to San Diego. And that's really hard to do if you haven't tried it. Not moving to San Diego, but moving in sobriety. And moving to San Diego is really easy. But I started going to a meeting in Allied Gardens, which is how I ended up here, on Tuesday nights, because when I moved down here, I knew somebody in San Diego who, I knew lots of people, but I knew somebody in San Diego that I used to sponsor in Los Angeles, and I knew she wasn't going to meetings. And so I said, I'm coming down here, I'm going to show you how this works, so you're going to find a meeting near your home, and you and I'll go to this meeting together. And so she took me to the Tuesday night Allied Gardens smoker step study, and which is around the corner from her house. And so I've been going to that meeting for the 5 years that I've been down here. She doesn't go to this meeting anymore, but I do. And when I first started going there, Paul goes to that meeting, and so I met Paul along with everybody else. And that meeting at the time had a commitment to answer phones at central office on, and I've forgotten what day of the month it was, but it doesn't make any after-hours phones. It doesn't make any difference. Paul and I signed up to answer the phones at the same time at, you know, some god-awful hour, 3 o'clock in the morning or something. And so we sat there and talked and answered phones for that particular hour. And he's profound, you know. And so I think of Paul as having all these years of sobriety and knowing all about what's going on, you know. And I'm this newcomer because, you know, I've been down here, I don't know, 3 months. And you know, I don't know anything. So that's my sense of Paul. It's amazing how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive others and how our perceptions of ourselves change from when we're drinking to when we're sober. I don't think my perception of myself is any more realistic today than it was then, but at least it's different, okay? I've made that much progress anyhow. I spent part of today discussing a fourth step. That's as opposed to hearing a fifth step. We were talking about the fourth step with somebody else I sponsor, and we were talking about that shift in perception that one gets when one does a fourth step and goes on to doing a fifth step, because now I have a mirror to work for, and that's the person that I'm doing the fifth step with, and I can see what's going on with me through the eyes of somebody else. I've learned to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know how to do that. My mirror was the model, and that was a very effective mirror for me. It kept me completely unrelated to reality of any sort. And I liked that. That's where I wanted to be. I suppose I should start a little closer to the beginning rather than the end. I don't have an exciting drunkalogue, so you're not going to get a whole lot of drinking stories. I'm sorry about that. It's just the way it is. My sobriety date is July 6, 1983. It is not an accident that it is July 6. July 4 for me was an excuse for years for doing nothing but celebrating with a lot of alcohol. Gave me an excuse to drink in the morning. I didn't do any morning drinking. I got here telling you I didn't drink in the morning. But I drank in the morning if you gave me an opportunity, and July 4 was one of those opportunities. And so, you know, I could start early and continue on. And so every 4th of July, we had a party, and I got drunk. And so my sobriety date is the 6th, because that year, her story gets longer. But it really does. But that's, you know, I thought I had to be sober to check into the treatment center I was going into, and so I was sober on July, you know, 5 to July 6 to check into this treatment. I found out later that you didn't have to do that, that most people went in drunk. My roommate in that treatment center showed up on the 4th of July because she got drunk enough that her husband dragged her in there on the 4th of July. So her sobriety date was the 4th of July, and she never let me forget that she had 2 days more than I did. I have to talk about her. This year in the past tense, she died in March of complications related to myasthenia gravis, which is a MS-type disease. But she and I stayed in close contact for 23 and a half years. And I think that is one of the reasons why I'm still here. It's because when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I latched on to a group of women who had about the same length of time I did. And we traveled in a pack for my first year of sobriety. And when I was ready to go out because I couldn't stand what was going on any longer, they dragged me. And when they were about to go out because they couldn't stand it any longer, I dragged them. And we managed to stay sober for long enough to figure out what it looked like to stay sober. And if I can't say anything else tonight, my mantra here is keep coming back, because I don't know any other way to get this besides showing up. And one of the things you do, what happens to you if you show up all long enough, is that you end up here, see? Suit up and show up is what they tell me. And I've ended up with commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous because I've suited up and showed up and not been qualified to do anything, you know, as far as the commitment was concerned. I was listening to the traditions tonight, specifically the one about service boards and committees. This is not my favorite way to be of service. Neither is serving as chairman of a committee, which is what I'm doing this year, because I showed up, you know, and so somebody said, oh, gee, she'd make a good chairperson, and so now I'm the chairperson. And I hate to tell you, one of the things about having a lot of sobriety is that you're supposed to look good, right? And this committee, I do not look good. So I don't know. Anyway, it's not been an easy couple of years for me from the, you know, look good point of view. I think God's trying to tell me something here. I need to start paying attention. I think that I was born an alcoholic. If I look back on my alcoholism and my drinking patterns, I would say that from the very beginning, I drank like an alcoholic. I didn't start drinking right away. I didn't start drinking till I left home, my parents' home, and went to college. And I went to a women's college, and back in the old days, forgive that, but there it is. And there were a lot of rules and regulations, not the least of which were curfews. And so the way we did this was to study during the week and you know, go out and party on the weekends. And so you went to the men's college down the road or the local bar or wherever it was you went. And you drank from whatever time you started, 7:30 at night, until midnight, because that was curfew. And then you showed up at home or in the dorm. And because of that, my drinking didn't look weird to me. It looked like I was doing what everybody else was. I don't think today that I was, but that's what it looked like at the time. So that's what I assumed one did. Never occurred to me to have one drink. The pattern here wasn't one drink. I don't think I ever thought I was going to have one drink in my life. My goal was always to have that, you know, enough so that I was not present and not enough so that I was really not present. I guess that's a good way to put it. And I couldn't maintain that at all. I mean, that just never happened for me. I either went way too far or I never got enough. You know, those were my two options as far as I could see. One of the things that allowed me to maintain my little illusion that I was drinking like other people was the other symptom of my alcoholism that I recognized from the beginning, and that is my capacity. I could drink most of them under the table, you know, so I didn't look drunk. And that didn't change for a long time, that I could consume large quantities of alcohol and not seem to be drunk. In the end, my MO was to maintain a lot. So I drank a lot, over a long period of time. So I was never sober and I was never drunk, you know. I mean, just the way it was. But I maintained this sort of weekend nonsense at college for a long time. Did my drinking get me in trouble? Yeah. Did it get me in trouble in such a way that it made any difference to me? No. And so I got out of college and got married, because that's what you did, and at least that's what I did, and moved to Chicago because that's where my husband was from, and proceeded to drink periodically if we went to parties or we did something. I was not in the daily drinking phase yet. I don't think it's an accident I married the man I married. He was not an alcoholic, but I would tell you that his mother was, only because she was my drinking buddy for the next 17 years. She and I would stay up. We'd go to dinner at his parents' house, and she and I would stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning drinking and talking. And it's a good thing, guys, that she blacked out before I did, because I know I told her things that no mother-in-law should ever hear. On the other hand, she told me lots of things no daughter-in-law should ever hear either, so we're even on that score. The hard part of that, ironically, was when I got sober, because I didn't know how to deal with this relationship when I got sober, and she didn't get sober, and she wasn't interested in getting sober, and I truly did not get sober gracefully. I mean, I didn't stop drinking and suddenly become, you know, comfortable in relationships and able to deal with people, and so she and I had a really rough time of it, and she died before I had an opportunity to get through all of that, come out the other side, and know how to make amends to her. So that's been the kind of thing where God has put into my life lots of opportunities for me to make the amends I should have made to her with other people. And I've been able to put some of that into practice. But I'm always sorry about that, you know. They're just some things you're sorry about. It's not regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. It's just sorry, you know. Oh, well. Where was I? I was drinking, not sober. Get back there. Told you I'd rather talk about my sobriety. That's because it's better, you know. I like talking about the good stuff, which is the sobriety, not the drinking stuff. I got pregnant, and my husband decided he needed to do something to make more money so that we could raise this child, and so we were living in Chicago, and he was working in the movie industry, and so he moved to Los Angeles so that he could do something about this. In improving his financial circumstances, and he left me with a full-time job and the baby in Chicago, and basically he said, I'll see you in a couple of years, and I discovered a whole lot of stuff at that point, you know, one of which is I can't do this all by myself. The other thing was that we had no friends, that we were literally living in each other's back pockets, and so I had no support system at all. And I did what any good alcoholic would do. Did I look for a solution that made any sense? No, I just used the bottle. So the MO became, you know, get up, get the baby to the babysitter, get to work, spend the day working, come home, deal with the colicky baby until 9 or 9:30 at night. No wonder this baby was colicky. Your mother was insane. get her to bed and then have two stiff drinks so that I could get some sleep so that I could get up in the morning and repeat this. And I'm an alcoholic, so you know where that two stiff drinks went. At the end of this, I was drinking at any opportunity I got, which meant I was coming home from work on a regular work day, and at 5 o'clock, and by 5:02, I had a drink in my hand, and I drank. I was usually blacked out by 8 o'clock. I have no idea what I did in the evening. And I'd come to in the bed in the morning and get up and go to work. Did I drink in the morning? Yeah, I discovered that, yeah. If you put me on an airplane, I drank. So if you put me on an airplane at 6 in the morning, I drank. If you let me mow the lawn, I had to have a beer after that. I usually mowed the lawn early Saturday morning. It was too hot to do it later in the day. So that just started the chain of events earlier. I truly think that the reason that, alcohol takes a long time, okay? Lots of people are getting here younger because they had other help. For whatever reason, I didn't have other help. So I used alcohol, and it took forever for me to figure out that there was a problem. Alcohol was my solution. How could it be my problem? And it took a long time. And there was no alcoholism in my family, so I didn't know what my drinking looked like to other people. I wasn't doing this in public. I was doing it at home. And I was aware that, you know, there were times when I shouldn't be doing this, but I truly didn't have a sense of the impact. Nobody hit me over the head with it. I was talking about that mirror. I didn't have the mirror to look to see what was going on. I just thought this was my reality. Oh, well. And I wasn't happy, you know. I kept hoping I would get happy if I drank. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I've been told in here a lot that happiness is an inside job and it's not going to come out of the bottle. It's not going to come out of a lot of other stuff either, so that's taken me a long time. But I early figured out it wasn't going to come out of the bottle because it wasn't. What happened is that finally my husband, whose mother, remember, was drinking like I was, so my drinking didn't seem weird to him. I looked like what his mother was doing. But he finally figured out that there was something definitely wrong there. So he suggested that maybe I should do something about my drinking. Now, that's not what I heard, but that's what he suggested. I truly don't know what he said. All I know is that I heard it. You know, and what I heard was, if you don't do something about your drinking, your life is about to come apart, and you are not going to like what happens. And that was just enough to scare me into thinking about doing something about my drinking. But I didn't know what to do. Alcoholics Anonymous was not a part of my vocabulary at the time. And I was lucky. The television was running ads at the time for inpatient treatment programs. They had become popular. Specifically, a 10-day program with a couple of 2-day follow-ups that would cure you of your alcoholism. I said to my husband, you know, if you can find me a treatment program that doesn't deal in aversion therapy, which is what that particular program dealt in, I will. Aversion therapy is throwing up, okay? I didn't like that when I was drinking. I don't like that now, and I didn't want to use that as my solution. Thank you. He did. He found the program at the Valley Presbyterian Hospital, which was, you know, in the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles. And they had their own treatment program. I mean, it wasn't a licensed, it was their own program, you know, it wasn't one of the chartered programs. And so that's what I did. I went through their 21-day inpatient program. Now, to show you how eager I was to do this, in March, we went and talked to them about going through this program, and they did what they do, which is check out your insurance, and said, yeah, you know, I was qualified to do it. And when did I think I wanted to do it? And I said, well, let me check my calendar. And my sobriety date is July 6th, remember? Ooh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Took me 3 months to get up the courage to do it. And what I did was to get really drunk on the 4th of July and decide on the 5th of July. I was now unemployed, decided on the 5th of July that I had the courage to do this, and I called up the program and said, I called up the center and said, you know, I'd like to come in tomorrow if that would be okay. And the nurse on the other end of the phone said, well, you don't sound too drunk. And I was offended at that. Gee whiz. So anyhow, so I checked in on the 6th of July, and I said I was unemployed. I was unemployed because the company that I was working for had been bought by a larger company. Sounds familiar today, but it didn't then. And they were moving the headquarters from Los Angeles back to Stamford, Connecticut. And so they laid me off. And I would, obviously this has nothing to do with my alcoholism, except that I was in the kind of position where had I been a good employee, they would have said, gee, come to Stamford with us. We really would like to have you. And they didn't say that. And they didn't say that because I was an alcoholic employee and behaving in ways that did not make me a good employee. I was not drinking on the job, but my attitude stank. I guess that's a polite way to put it. It was awful. And I did all of the things that, I don't remember where I was reading it recently, but all the stuff that they talk about in the to the employer, you know, I was just an awful employee. I had a rotten attitude. And I was either better than or lonely, no good whatsoever, which was, you know, my condition anyway, but there it was. And I just was not a wonderful employee. So they laid me off, and that was probably the nicest thing they could have done for me, because what it did do was, you know, push from the other side. So now I didn't have any choice but to go into this treatment program. So I spent 21 days in the hospital drying out. It was nice I went through a treatment program. I think it's the most wonderful thing in the world that I did that. It allowed me to dry out in safety, and it introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were 4 meetings a week involved with this particular unit. I say it that way. We work really hard at no affiliation here, so understand when I say this that I am not talking about affiliation in any way, shape, or form. There were 2 meetings that were brought into the unit. They were open to the AA community. They were closed meetings, but they were open to the AA community. It wasn't just the people on the unit who were at those meetings. And there were 2 meetings a week that we were taken to, both of them large speaker meetings. And so we had the experience of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as going through groups and getting individual therapy and doing physical exercise and all the other things that you do in an inpatient program. And after 21 days, I was terrified to go out to the real world. I had, you know, my reality had reduced itself to this little tiny place. And I knew I could stay sober there. I didn't have a choice. At least I didn't perceive I did. And besides which, all the people around me wanted me to be sober. You know, they were interested in my sobriety. And I was self-centered enough to want them to be interested in my sobriety. I didn't get sober gracefully. And so, yeah, at the end of 21 days, they had a little, you know, this is what you should do to maintain your sobriety. And none of the things are things you haven't heard 250 million times in here. You should get a sponsor, a temporary one if you can't find, you know, a permanent one of your own right now. You should go to meetings. Why don't you have a meeting schedule plan for meetings that are around your house so that you know where they are? Here is the directory. You should go to aftercare. It is free. It is part of the inpatient care program, and it will keep you connected with the people that you have been seeing here so that you will have people who are familiar to you. It didn't sound like anything you haven't heard. And I did that. Miracle of miracles. This is how my higher power works in my life. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea what was going on, and I had no idea what was going to happen to me, and all I wanted to do was stop drinking. I understood that that's what I wanted to do. And I was allowed to stay in these rooms long enough for me to start understanding what those silly, where'd they go, silly steps over there that are plastered on the wall meant to me and how they could work for me in my life. And that wasn't 30 days. That was a lot closer to 2.5 years. And the only thing I did right in that 2.5 years was to keep coming back. So, and I got here, and things got worse. I'm absolutely serious. You know, you take an alcoholic, this is a family disease. I was the alcoholic, but my husband and my daughter had no idea what to do with a sober alcoholic. They were gung-ho by going into this treatment program. They thought this was going to be wonderful. But what they had pictured was, you know, that I'd come out sober and great, you know, and there wouldn't be any other changes. Oh, come on, guys. What do we have to change in here? Everything, right? And as I said, I didn't do it gracefully. You know, my first choices of things to change were I wasn't going to make dinner anymore. Oh, come on. Hey, you know, you got to start somewhere, right? So that's what the early sobriety looked like. And these people, my husband and my daughter, who were gung-ho. My daughter, by the way, is 13, okay? If you must get sober with a teenager in the house, okay. But that's not the recommended way to do this. Not at all. Anyhow, they wanted me to be sober for the first 30 days. Along about 60 days, they thought maybe this was a little more than they had bargained for, and by 90 days, they were ready for me to start drinking again. Please! Anything but this. And things really did get worse. Because the 13-year-old started acting out, and my husband started doing things that you know, like holding wine glasses under my hand at a party, under my nose at a party, and saying, "Gee, don't you wish you could have some of this?" I want you to hear something. I don't remember that. I don't remember that. I had somebody tell me that he was being cruel to me, and told me that story. So I do not recall his doing that. So, you know, my reality and my perception in that early sobriety is just, I'm going to sit here and tell you what I think happened, but boy, you know, may not have anything to do with what really happened. I don't know. I can look back on some of it about the same way I look back on my drinking, you know, and I can see things that went on then and think, oh my God, I wish I'd known, because I wouldn't have done that, you know, and I probably wouldn't have, but oh well, you know, I quit making dinner. Who else can use the blame here? What happened for that first 2 years is that things got worse at home, and things got a lot better in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to my home group was the group that I had been going to when I was in the inpatient unit. And that Friday night meeting became my home group meeting. It was a meeting that was about this size. The difference was that it was held in the hospital auditorium, and all those lights were, you know, turned off, and the speaker was downlit, and the, you know, so I thought the speaker and the secretary were the most important people in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was you know, an atmosphere of bar drinking. It was really nice, actually. Cool arrangement. And I felt right at home, you know. It was very comfortable. I had a sponsor, because I had called up the temporary sponsor program and said, I'm in need of a sponsor, and the person on the other end of the phone said, well, I do. And the person on the other end of the phone was somebody who had been part of the volunteers coming into the unit, taking people out to their AA meetings. And she was the president of AA as well, as far as I was concerned. And so I was really impressed that she was willing to be my temporary sponsor, and she was my temporary sponsor for, I don't know really how long, 3.5 years until she moved, and I discovered rapidly that I can't do long-distance sponsorship. I actually sponsor a couple of people now that live in Los Angeles, and they do long-distance sponsorship fine, but that didn't work for me. So she was my sponsor, and I had, you know, 8 other ladies that I was hanging out with, and the ladies is a generic term here. It does not refer to our... Never mind. you understand. Anyhow, and we hung out together at the back of this room, and we went to coffee after the meeting, and my sponsor, I kept saying to my sponsor, you don't understand, you know, my daughter is out running away and getting into trouble, and you know, my husband isn't happy with my going to meetings, and he's complaining a lot, and I can't do this. And she'd say, come on, we'll go to coffee, and I'd go to coffee, and I became the cake lady at that meeting. And that was one of those meetings where you brought a cake. It was a big meeting, so you brought a cake for each person who was taking a cake, and there would be 6-8 people taking cakes any given Friday night. So, yeah, I bring 6 cakes and line them up on this table up here and put candles on them. And I couldn't commit suicide on Thursday night because I had the cakes at the meeting on Friday. Now, that was my out when I got here. You know, if I couldn't do this, if I couldn't get this, then I'd commit suicide. Because there wasn't anything else. And so it was that was a thought of mine on a regular basis. I didn't act on it, but it was a thought of mine on a regular basis for that first 2 years of my sobriety. And I thought, I can't do it Thursday night. I've got to bring all these cakes on Friday. I was sure the cake person was the most important person in AA. I didn't discover it was the coffee person for a long time. Then I had to do the coffee commitment, not at the same meeting. But what that commitment, let's look at it and say, you know, I'm not doing this commitment because I'm being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm doing this commitment because it makes me important. It doesn't matter why you do the commitment, just do it. Because it brings you here. And that was what I learned. You know, I did that commitment. It was a 6-month commitment. I did it for 18 months. And at the end of 18 months, I told you where you could put that commitment. I was so angry at it. That hasn't changed, by the way. I still do that. I do not know how to say no, period. But I really don't know how to say no in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was told you can't say no to an AA request. And I haven't learned to give up the commitment when I'm supposed to. So, oh well. And someday I will learn these things. That's why I keep coming back. I get to learn these things. Eventually, I'll do this gracefully, I figure. You know, I haven't found that word yet in the steps or in the little bit about the afterwards. What an order I can't go through with it. I can't go through with it gracefully. No, never mind. I could try. Where was I? So I was hanging out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and AA was wonderful. You know, I was going to either a meeting or aftercare or something every night. And my MO for drinking was to come home from work and have a drink in my hand right away, so I didn't dare. In the beginning, my solution to that was just not to go home right away. And so I would go from work to the aftercare meeting or the AA meeting or the whatever I went to, and then I would go home, hence not making dinner, in case you haven't figured that part of it out yet. But what that did was that it helped me in the very beginning to not have to not repeat the same stuff that I was doing when I was drinking. It just helped me to not have to pick up the drink. The other thing I did was to always have something, a cup, a bottle of water with me, so that I always had liquid with me, a Diet Coke. Didn't make any difference what it was, but I had liquid with me so that I had something that I was drinking that wasn't alcohol. And that made life easier for me. I was trying to think of some of the other cute little tricks. I did the first step almost right away, because I came in here wanting to drink, wanting not to drink. I knew that I was an alcoholic. I was more than willing to be an alcoholic. I just didn't want to be crazy, which is what I was afraid was wrong with me. I thought you would lock me up if you knew what was going on in my head. Some days I still think that, but I'm better. You know, I'm better. And so admitting I was powerless over alcohol was really easy for me. It was really obvious to me that I was powerless over alcohol, and that if I didn't do it, life was going to be much more comfortable from my point of view. However, I didn't think my life was unmanageable. I manage my life and your life and the weather and anything else that was available to manage, and a few things that weren't available to manage, and I thought I was doing just fine at it. You know, so it took me a long time to realize that my life was unmanageable. I wanted to manage that child, and I wanted to manage that husband, and I wanted to manage, you know, what was going on at work, and I just wanted to manage everything. So I had a hard time understanding what having my life be unmanageable was supposed to look like. And it's really hard to have God restore you to sanity if you aren't insane. And since I went from good, I'm not crazy, to, you know, I'm only an alcoholic, it was hard for me to accept that I was insane so that I could be restored to sanity, if you see where I'm coming from with that. So my sponsor and I went around in circles with all of this stuff for a long time, and she said, "We're going to quit this debating. Forget it. We're doing the third step, and you're going on to an inventory." And so at 6 months of sobriety, she and I and my friend, roommate from the unit, and her sponsor went to the little chapel at the Valley Presbyterian Hospital, where the auditorium was. And we went in there and knelt down at the little altar and held hands and said the third step prayer. And that was my third step. And I went on and, quote, immediately started on my fourth step. And I actually completed my fourth and fifth step by the time I had a year of sobriety. God works in mysterious ways. And it was another year before I figured out what 1, 2, and 3 really looked like. The family stuff was not getting any better for all of this inventory. My MO for writing this inventory was to sit down at the table while my daughter was doing her homework, and she would do her homework and I would write my inventory. My besetting character defect at the time, and probably still, is intense self-pity. I do it well. And the problem with self-pity is not the pity part, it's the self part. But so the MO for writing this thing was to write down all of this stuff and start feeling sorry for myself and start crying, so that I couldn't finish writing because I was crying too hard. And so then I put it away and start again the next day. My first fourth step was not the most wonderful thing in the world, but it did two things for me. One was to let me understand how to do a fourth step. I mean, I actually had this idea that you took pen and wrote down on paper. Being able to talk about some of that stuff with my sponsor gave me a real sense of how 4 and 5 worked from that. She could see things that I couldn't see, point of view, and that I could actually make some progress in getting better. And so I'm no longer afraid to do a fourth step. I'm no longer uncomfortable with the idea of doing a fourth step. I'm not always good at it in the sense of being able to see what's going on, But I'm more than willing to do it, because what I can see over a long period of time is how effective that is in my life when I do the steps, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, in that kind of order. So that was very nice. I don't know about my daughter's homework. I don't know whether it improved or didn't improve, because I was sitting there with her writing my little fourth step. I told her one day that I put her in my God box, and she looked at me as if I were absolutely nuts. And I want you to know that the best place I ever put her was in my God box. At 2 years of sobriety, my husband came home and said, "You know, this has to change." And I said, "Okay, I'll move out." It wasn't the answer he wanted to hear, and I knew that. But it was probably the best thing that happened for us, because what happened was that I moved out. I moved to an apartment just down the street, and my daughter stayed in the house because I said, "Do you want to come with me?" She says, "I don't think I should make that choice." I said, "Good, you're staying in the house because you have your own room there, and the apartment wasn't that big." And so she and my husband stayed in the house, and I was just as miserable in that apartment as I ever was in the house with them. It became really clear to me that my problems were not my husband and my daughter, that my problems were me. And I had an opportunity to start looking at what was going on with me and stop looking at what was going on with them. So that was absolutely the blessing in disguise. My husband decided to go on a weekend sailing trip, and so he did. And my daughter took advantage of the fact that there weren't any parents home, and she had a party, and it did what all parties for teenagers do when they have parties and their parents aren't home. The police got called by the neighbors, and the police showed up, and the housekeeper who was there called me up and said, "You know, you got to come here and do something." And so I came home and came to the house and confiscated the alcohol in the pot and told my daughter she was grounded, and she did what any well-respecting, 14-and-a-half-year-old child would do. She ran away from home. And I thought, I'm still under the illusion I'm supposed to have control over this, right? So I'm pacing the floor and calling my sponsor and going to start grating bananas over the whole thing and having no idea what's going to happen next. And I'm backed into another one of those corners, I've been jammed up against the wall at one more time. And my prayers stopped being, "God, bring her home safely," and started being, "God, you take care of her because I can't." And that really was steps 1, 2, and 3, bingo, right there. And I understood for the first time what it really meant to let go, what it really meant to turn her over to God, and therefore, by extrapolation or whatever you want to use, to be able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And because that was such a painful experience, nothing in my sobriety since then has been as hard to turn over. Now, do I do it all the time purposely? No, thank you. I have to hang on to things because I have to hang on to things. That's what's important around here. But what happens for me is that once I see that that's what I'm doing, it's really easy for me to say, "Oh, that's what I'm doing. Okay," and turn it over. Because it's such a relief to doing that once I come to the point of figuring that out. So I've been able to get through lots of stuff in sobriety because I've learned the hard way, how to do this. But the hard way is keep coming back and deal with what gets thrown in your path, and that's how it works. Two quick things. One is that at 10 years of sobriety, my husband asked me for a divorce. And I had a really hard time understanding that. I thought we had been through, I mean, this is now 30 years of marriage, and I thought we'd been through all of this stuff. And he said at one point in this thing, you know, I don't know what to do. I don't know whether this is my will or God's will. And I, to my credit, okay, I had 10 years of sobriety. I didn't laugh at him for that. What I did do was to look at what God's will for me might be in those circumstances. And it became clear to me that God didn't care whether I was married or divorced. That wasn't what this was about. That this was about, I was supposed to be of maximum service to God and the people around me. That's out of the book. And whatever that looked like, it didn't make any difference. So that this was not a God's out to get me thing or a he's out to get me thing. And I could, we're back to not gracefully, but I could learn to let go of that and not take it quite so personally. Actually, I truly think it was not aimed personally. I think he had his own thing he had to do, and that it had very little to do with me personally. And I think that because he married somebody who's just like me. So, you know. And that's not my information. That's information that's given to me by people who know both of us. So, I never believe myself anymore, right? The other thing I want you to know is that I moved down here 5 years ago because my daughter asked me if I would be willing to take care of my grandchildren. She was 13 when I got sober. I can do for my grandchildren here what I could not do for her because I was drinking. This has to be the best amends that God could have put in my life. And it's not because I went and looked for the amends or what to do or how to do it. It's because it landed in my lap. And that's been my experience with the ninth step, is that while I'm more than willing to say, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, what can I do to make it right, and do that when I see that I need to make an amends, the living amends that I need to make in my life have always come to me from God through whatever's going on in my life. Thank you very much for being willing to listen to me babble on tonight, and thank you for letting me participate in my own sobriety.